Welcome to the Savvy Shrink podcast, brought to you by MHNRnetwork.com. I'm your host, Andrea Schneider. I'm a licensed clinical social worker, therapist, and life coach. I will be sharing helpful information for individuals dealing with varying mental health challenges, ranging from trauma and loss to recovering from toxic relationships in love, work, and family, specifically as relates to narcissistic abuse recovery. Other poignant topics will include maternal mental health and special needs parenting, among others. The podcast welcomes guests who share their expertise in trauma-informed and evidence-based interventions, including the latest in neuropsychology. My ebook, Soul Vampires: Reclaiming Your Lifeblood After Narcissistic Abuse, is available at BookBaby and other digital online booksellers. I'm a believer in a strengths-focused perspective for my clients, which harnesses the power of internal wisdom and crafting the inner alchemy of healing. Please grab a cup of coffee or tea, and welcome to The Savvy Shrink. The Savvy Shrink is honored to have Bree Bonche here today to join us. She is a licensed psychotherapist and licensed clinical social worker with 2 decades of experience working in the field of mental health and trauma recovery. Bree specializes in helping people recover from toxic relationships, and she shares her insights about narcissistic personality disorder and psychopathy in her blog, Free From Toxic. Her articles have been featured in major online magazines, and she's appeared on radio shows as a guest expert. She is a dedicated advocate. In 2016, Bree founded World Narcissistic Abuse Awareness Day, which is celebrated every 1st of June. Bree is a board member of the Association for NPD Psychopathy Educators and Survivor Treatment, and she's also a member of the International Association of Trauma Specialists. Bree's information can be found on her website, freefromtoxic.com, where she describes her resources, including teletherapy, some bibliotherapy options, her blog, and additional resources. We're very thrilled to have Bree Bonche here today. Thank you for joining us. Bree, welcome.
Thank you, Andrea. I'm so honored to be here.
Just thrilled to have you to share your wonderful wisdom with our listeners today. They're in for such a treat because you have a wealth of information and resources that will help so many people. So we're just really thrilled to have you here today. And we're going to just go ahead and dig right into some meaty questions because we know that you're going to be able to help us out here. So what do you find is the most challenging aspect of recovery for survivors when they're trying to heal from a pathological relationship?
Well, you know, the more I do this work and the more I work with survivors of pathological relationships, the more I'm convinced that the most challenging aspect is overcoming cognitive dissonance. Yes. And I also believe it's so critical. It's like a really critical piece as well, mm-hmm. but not just overcoming it, but really learning how to make it or bring it to a level of awareness and resolve that dissonance in a conscious and healthy way. Definitely. So, yeah. You know, I probably should, if it's all right with you, explain what it is for people who might not know what it is.
Share with us so we can learn what this is, because I think it's pretty universal. Most survivors have that experience of cognitive dissonance. They don't know what it is, but learning what it is so empowering and helpful. So please let us know what it is.
Yeah, I know that it's probably in the top 3 things that drives people into treatment. At least that's what I see. You know, that's one of the symptoms that they're just so struggling with so much and so challenging. But so what it is, it's really just a psychological term that describes the mental stress of holding 2 completely conflicting thoughts or mm-hmm. beliefs or values. Or when your behavior is completely contradictory to your beliefs or thoughts or values. Mm-hmm. And it's just that tension. It can be felt in different ways. Some people feel it as anxiety or discomfort, or some people even get depressed or ruminate about it. And it sort of got a bad rap because since it makes us feel uncomfortable, you know, we think of it as a bad thing, but it actually, cognitive dissonance itself can actually be helpful. And it's a normal brain function that really helps to protect us. You know, we like when our beliefs and ideas and our actions are all in agreement. That makes us feel good. It makes us feel competent. But what happens is, in toxic relationships, it can really work against us and survivors.
Mm.
So
absolutely.
that's a quick little description of what it is.
Right. It's so helpful. It really is. I think it's important for survivors to know what it is, simply because the psychoeducation piece of healing is such a key piece of recovery. So that's really good information. Thank you.
It really is. It really is. And so the cognitive dissonance itself isn't necessarily it's uncomfortable and it doesn't feel good, but what really is the bad thing, what's really dangerous, is it enables us to justify bad behavior or rationalize bad behavior or even deny there's a problem.
Yeah.
And, you know, it helps us deceive ourselves, and we're really good at that, right? Like, we can fool ourselves into believing things that are true. I guess we can fool ourselves into believing that things that are true aren't, and disbelieving things that are true. We do that all the time. Mm-hmm. So
yes, it's very true.
I can, you know, give an example so that, you know, since everybody has cognitive dissonance, it's not always about things that are important, could be, you know, but sometimes when it is, it can really, really be damaging.
Mm.
But so one example that I think a lot of people might relate to is if you're on a diet, but then you dive headfirst into a loaf of banana nut bread.
That's a good example.
Right?
Uh-huh. Yep.
So like, you know, what happens is we resolve that, and it's unconscious, it's instantaneous, it's not like we're doing it on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And we might say something to ourselves like, well, there's worse things I can eat, or, you know, well, actually banana nut bread has bananas and nuts and those are good for you. Or, you know, we could just sort of try to get rid of that stress, that feeling of not having our actions and our beliefs be in alignment. We have to get rid of that by doing these like unconscious mental gymnastics.
Mm, good point.
And another example that for survivors that I hear a lot is, you know, they'll tell me that being in a healthy relationship is really important to them.
Mm-hmm.
But then they're in an abusive relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So that causes a lot of stress, and that, you know, because their belief, their value of wanting to be in a healthy and reciprocal relationship is in direct opposition to the fact that they're staying with somebody that's cruel and abusive to them.
Yes, it just seems so diametrically opposed. It's like, on the one hand, you know, maybe the abuser has some positive qualities, and then on the other hand, then there's these horrific abusive qualities. So it's sort of like this trauma bond that forms, isn't it, that really develops.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's kind of why I feel that it's so critical to recovery to make that process a conscious process. And anytime we're making a process that's unconscious conscious, it's challenging.
Mm-hmm.
But it's critical because, this is in my personal opinion, you know, survivors can learn some really great, important skills. Like, they can develop healthy boundaries. They can learn, like you were talking about earlier, about a lot of that psychoeducation piece about learning about the pathological relationship cycle. They can learn about narcissistic personality disorder. They they can learn about the red flags and the warning signs. They can learn techniques to help them process their grief and techniques to help them reduce the impact of trauma. Those are so important and critical. But if they don't learn to resolve their cognitive dissonance in a healthy, conscious way, it's almost like all those other things are ineffective. It's like pouring clean, filtered water through a, you know, dirty filter and expecting the water to come out clean.
That's a good analogy for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's really helpful.
You know, I'm sure you've heard this, and I hear survivors and just anybody, really, we all said this at some point, where we'll see some red flags, or we'll see some warning signs, or we'll go out with somebody and we'll be like, you know, something just didn't sit right. You know, something was off about them,
right.
But you know, we'll ignore that, right? We'll ignore the warning signs.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's classic cognitive dissonance right there. And it didn't have anything to do with the fact that I didn't know the warning signs or red flags. It didn't have anything to do with the fact that I didn't have boundaries. I felt the rub, you know.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that kind of just shows that you can have all those other important pieces in place, but if you resolve that dissonance, that feeling, in an unhealthy way, then it really will just keep you stuck in toxic relationships or returning to toxic relationships.
Yes. And could you say a little bit more about that? Kind of leads me to my next question about how the dynamics of the pathological relationship add to the cognitive dissonance. Like you said, it's one thing for a survivor to know what they're dealing with, and psychoeducation is important, but how does that keep them stuck? What can they do to extricate out of a very toxic situation? And how those dynamics manifest in the pathological relationship?
Yeah, you know, I mean, pathological relationships, when you think about them, it's a perfect storm to set the survivor up for cognitive dissonance. There's just, it's like everything that either causes or increases cognitive dissonance is present in a pathological relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And so for one, any relationship, whether it's pathological or not, it is tied to somebody's self-concept. I mean, our relationships are, you know, totally tied to our identities. They make up who we are and how we feel about ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And anything that's tied to our self-concept will automatically cause stronger feelings of cognitive dissonance when over something that's not tied to our self-concept.
Okay.
So that's one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then in a pathological relationship, in the beginning, the pathological person, they tend to isolate the survivor, right? So they'll isolate the survivors from their friends, their family, supportive people. And so really, the survivor doesn't get the exposure to the influence and the opinions of others. So what happens is that sort of keeps the survivor in that cave of cognitive dissonance, in a sense, because they don't have somebody sort of challenging their rationalizations and their justifications and all the things that are keeping them stuck in that relationship. So that completely makes it more difficult and strengthens the cognitive dissonance. And then even at the end of the relationship, I don't know if you see this, but I do, survivors will then tend to self-isolate. So even people that they can be in contact with that would be a good support, they tend to self-isolate because they're aware on some level that if they were to say, Andrea, my partner, he's all these awful things. He's done all these horrible things to me, but I'm staying in this relationship. that would be met with a lot of resistance and judgment, and
so they tend,
and that would cause them a lot of anxiety, right? That would just worsen their cognitive dissonance, and they'd sort of be forced to, they'd be forced to sort of accept a reality that they're not ready to cope with.
Good point.
That sort of keeps them in the cogs of that cognitive dissonance as well.
Yes, I can see that. I agree. And I've seen that as well with some of the clients that I've worked with too. And it's almost like a sense of self-imposed, like you said, self-isolation, because it's sort of what they've learned at the very end, you know, of the relationship. And it kind of keeps them isolated. So it's almost a state of learned helplessness in a way, it feels like, for some people. And it reminds me of, you know, just working with clients and trying to help them to establish and deepen healthy social support networks in the aftermath and as they're healing and recovering. But it actually leads to my next question, which you're welcome to elaborate further on what we just talked about if you want, or we could move right into if you'd like to share some techniques or strategies that help survivors that they can use to help resolve their cognitive dissonance in a conscious, healthy way.
Sure. Yeah, I would like to elaborate because I think I think a really important piece, and you sort of alluded to it earlier with your comment about the trauma bonding.
Oh yeah.
In the beginning of the relationship, the love bombing and the mirroring, that also really reinforces and sort of sets the survivor up for cognitive dissonance as well.
Yeah.
Not only does, you know, all that flattery and love and attention and, you know, positive reflection sort of strengthen in the survivor's mind that their partner is just wonderful and the best person on the planet on an emotional and on a mental level.
Yeah.
But it also does it on a chemical level, right?
Sure.
Like I'm not a neuropsychologist, but we know that, you know, that triggers, that mirroring triggers oxytocin release and love bombing triggers dopamine release. So, so when the survivor, when the pathological person lets their hair down and their mask falls off, and it's so hard for the survivor to accept that what they're seeing is the real person, and that this person is actually abusive, because the beginning stage of the relationship just reinforced the belief so strongly on so many levels that this person is wonderful and you know, perfect.
Yeah.
So that definitely contributes to the survivor's cognitive dissonance as well, and and keeps them stuck. So, and then, you know, and then just the confusion that, you know, is inherent in all pathological relationships, and that feeling of walking on eggshells and being anxious all the time and worried and depressed. Research has shown that people who are anxious and depressed are more prone to cognitive dissonance. So again, another factor that, you know, it just makes that cognitive dissonance even stronger and more challenging.
For sure. And it certainly seems that it's fairly universal that survivors of this form of abuse really are so at risk for depression, anxiety, PTSD, complex PTSD. So, you know, it's just all kind of woven together. But yes, the trauma bond, I definitely can see how that manifests with my clients as well, and how, you know, that love bomb, it's like a hit of the worst drug you can ever imagine, but it's the best drug, kind of. It's such a high, and it's so mood altering and elevating for clients that they want to go back to that place of the way things were in the beginning. And so when that devaluation stage happens, and, you know, death by a thousand cuts, so to speak, occurs with the verbal abuse for a lot of clients, or maybe it's gaslighting, maybe it's silent treatment, projection, blame shifting, things like that. They're sort of woven in there very subtly at first, but then more obviously as time moves on. I see that's when a lot of people start to question, am I really with the same person I started to date at the very beginning? Or in the case of a parent, you know, that could also manifest there, or a toxic work relationship. It's sort of this type of pathological connection can occur in any of these life settings. And we're kind of talking about romantic connections, but this can happen also in family relationships and in work environments too. But I do see the manifestation of cognitive dissonance happening with clients when the devaluation stage starts to occur. And it's very overwhelming and heartbreaking. And it's no fun for anybody. My goodness, it's no fun. So, you know, this trauma bond, it can be broken, but there's a process involved, and it's a lot of recovery work. And I'm just so glad that you're here today to really help our listeners understand what they can be doing to really work through that cognitive dissonance and heal, and that there's hope for someone to get through this, because this is really rough. But say a little bit more. If you want to elaborate on that, you can, or you can share what you do in terms of techniques or strategies that you would recommend for survivors to help with this persnickety thing called cognitive dissonance.
Sure. Well, you know, one thing that I think we tend to do with survivors, let's say, for instance, they believe that their partner is wonderful, but they also mm-hmm. believe that their partner is cruel and abusive. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we'll tend to try to challenge that faulty belief, right? We'll point out all the facts, we'll get out the DSM,
right.
We'll go over the criteria for mm-hmm. NPD,
yeah.
We'll remind them of all the horrible things their partner has done to them, and try to connect the dots.
Right.
And I've done this with clients, and at the end of the session, they're feeling a lot less dissonance, they're feeling a little bit relieved. Mm-hmm. But what I've noticed, and this is sort of why I've just really started researching this more, is that within a week, their cognitive dissonance is back. And I kind of have some theories about why that is. It doesn't seem like challenging the faulty belief or thoughts, it has staying power. It helps, but it doesn't have any kind of like lasting staying power.
Okay.
So what I kind of believe, one, is that the first thing is, it's because we're not really teaching the survivors how to resolve that dissonance on a conscious level. So what happens is, when they're not challenging the beliefs, Or when someone else isn't helping them to challenge, they just kind of resort back into resolving it the way they've always done, you know? And and then my other thought is that, what, you know, cognitive dissonance increases. Everybody has sets a different weight or value on their thoughts. So if I think Johnny is abusive, and I write down 10 reasons that I think he's abusive, mm-hmm. and one of them is he's cruel to my brother, if I really love my brother, that might, you know, that might be kind of an important thought. Like, with you, you said, well, mean to your brother, and I might be like, yeah, that's important. But if I don't really like my brother, maybe that wouldn't weigh so heavily.
So
part of what happens is, when we're just challenging those faulty cognitions or beliefs that survivors have, it really depends upon the weight mm-hmm. or the value they place on different cognitions.
I actually
had this woman just recently mm-hmm. Tell me this, and so this will make sense. She was in an abusive relationship with a narcissist for a couple years. He was very abusive, very and physically violent. And she's recently returned to him. Of course, she hasn't told her family. She's having a lot of anxiety, and everything she's describing is she's in this state of cognitive dissonance. And I asked her, I said, so what thought enabled you to return to this man? And she said, well, he's been treating me nicer than he's ever treated me. So to me and to most people kind of on the outside, it's like, but what about all these bad things he's done?
Right, you know? Exactly.
Like, but to her, she's placing so much value and weight on the fact that he's treating her nicer than he's ever has. And and that's kind of what's keeping her trapped.
Yeah.
So it's sort of the weight of how, you know, the importance that survivors put on. I think that we need to explore too. And they need to explore.
I think you're spot on. Absolutely. And what that belief system is internally to them. And it seems that for many, it sort of taps into self-worth issues. Correct me if I'm wrong in your experience, but there's often like an earlier trauma, potentially, not always, for some people, that maybe they had their self-worth impacted potentially by a trauma or a loss or something that was kind of perceived neurologically as a trauma. So it sort of becomes the framework in a way of one's self-concept. And then that sort of creates a template for some survivors in terms of connecting with what might be familiar to them. It's not that all survivors have had a history of narcissistic abuse, because in fact, I've worked with many who have not. But, you know, if for some folks, I do believe there is a template that happens in family of origin. What is your take on that? And how would someone work through dealing with a concept, a self-concept of not feeling worthy, and sort of shift that and change that, you know, in terms of managing cognitive dissonance? And I know for me, I do a lot with EMDR with people, and I can't do that telephonically if I'm doing a telephone session with somebody, but I think there's a lot of work that can be done just through cognitive behavioral work as well, and reality testing, et cetera. Do you have other, you know, techniques or suggestions that you would recommend in addition to that, that might help survivors to resolve that cognitive dissonance?
Yeah. You know, so what I think it really is helpful is to have the survivor sort of see that behavior, the pathological behavior. And well, I should start off by saying, so what happens is they have a lot of positive memories of, of their abuser. And so what's a good way to sort of, have them do is sort of plot their positive memories on sort of a chart. And they then have them, try to recall, and you, they can always recall, because this, you know, there's always something that like some pathological behavior, some abusive behavior that happened just before the positive memory and right after. And if they can sort of anchor that positive memory, and they can see it in the context of the pathological relationship cycle, and either as a I'm going to set you up for abuse, or I'm just being nice to make up for the abuse. You know what I mean? And, and just, it kind of, that can help really, that's kind of a cognitive strategy to reduce the dissonance.
That's awesome. That's a really great idea. In essence, it's sort of like a timeline in a way where they can sort of see it visually, it sounds like too. And
absolutely.
That helps them to understand that there's, yes, there's some great parts of the relationship, but then there's some really crappy parts that are incredibly abusive. And those, once it's sort of visualized on sort of like a timeline, so to speak, it makes it real, I think, for a lot of people to see it.
Yeah, and it helps to sort of take that concept of he's good and he's bad and sort of make it into he's both. Do you know what I mean? Because
yes,
that helps to sort of resolve that. No, he's he's not good or bad. He's both. And this is part of that pathological personality. And this is the cycle. And
yes, the Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde type thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Or a woman. It could be a woman that's an abuser too in some cases.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So this is really great information. And I think that's helpful for survivors who are just really feeling stuck and needing to just really kind of work through that period of cognitive dissonance. And I know that many are just really feeling bummed out that it feels like recovery is taking so long and that, you know, maybe they've had a relationship breakup historically, but it wasn't with a pathological individual like a narcissist or even a psychopath. And it was painful, but it didn't take as long as the traumatic loss that they're walking through in the aftermath of a relationship with someone who might be an individual with NPD or maybe they're, you know, a psychopath. So I think hope is so important for the survivors we work with. And I know that they can be really kind of just stuck and feeling like, where's the light at the end of the tunnel? They might be stuck feeling like they have complex PTSD, depression, anxiety, panic attacks, etc. in the aftermath of narcissistic abuse. What hope do you have to offer survivors? What sorts of things do you like to say to encourage the people that you work with that there is a light at the end of the tunnel?
Yeah, that's a good question because they do come to us and they're just so devastated and broken and really just, you know, just not able to even function a lot of the time. One of the things that I think is helpful and also gives survivors hope is sort of to kind of prep them on what to expect from recovery and what recovery looks like.
Good.
So so when they have what feels like a setback, they're not completely derailed and thrown off guard. You know, because a lot of times that happens, like they'll think like they're not even, you know, making any progress because they'll have a flashback or something will trigger them and they'll think that they haven't made any progress at all. But really they have. It's sort of that black and white thinking that is typical of people with CPTSD. So they think in terms of all or nothing. And if they have one trigger or one flashback, that's proof to them that they're not healing. But so I like to try to sort of prep them and let them know that that's possible and to view that as a sign of progress, actually. Okay. And then the other thing is, you know, a lot of times that self-care that survivors need to do when they have PTSD and to calm their nervous system, that can feel so... it could just feel just so foreign to them and so counterintuitive. And actually doing those things can actually trigger flashbacks because they're so used to being abandoned or rejected when they act in their self-interest and they take care of themselves. So doing things that actually are in their self-interest can sort of trigger that like a flashback. So I just like to kind of prep them that should be also viewed as progress, not that they're not making progress because they're starting to act in their self-interest. And sometimes things may feel like they're getting worse, but they're not, you know, and sometimes things actually do have to get a little worse before they get better.
For sure. Sort of like a holding pattern, like an airplane in a holding pattern. It might be taking a while to land, but you know, landing is imminent and it's just a little bit of a pause for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. Maybe the brain is synthesizing information or the individual might be trying to learn other pathways of coping and maybe try to express some of that held trauma through yoga, meditation, something like that, that maybe initially might bring about some tension, but as they're exposed to self-regulation and some of these relaxation techniques, in time, I've seen a lot of survivors really benefit from some of those physiological modalities like yoga, meditation, hiking, walking, you know, things that we take for granted. But, you know, now we have evidence that really supports that these are really trauma-informed and helpful interventions. But it does take practice and exposure to it to really have it be something that's beneficial, it seems.
Definitely. Those are definitely all things that are, like you said, that we're finding that are essential, mm-hmm. you know, really essential to recovery from these types of relationships.
Definitely. And I think you mentioned self-care. I think that's such an important piece of the whole thing. And that, you know, a lot of survivors haven't really spent a lot of time thinking about what self-care means to them. And for each person, that might be different too. For one person, it might mean having a pedicure or getting a facial. But for the next person, maybe that doesn't have the funds for that, maybe it's simply allowing oneself to not be productive or to carve out some time to take a nap or, you know, call a friend or meet somebody for a cup of tea or what have you. It can look like different things. It doesn't have to be some pressured perfectionistic notion of what self-care, quote unquote, should look like. And I think self-care is very unique to the survivor, but part of our job also as clinicians is to help the therapist or the client to find what works for them to help their body to self-regulate, self-soothe, and to reach a place of relaxation. So I completely agree with you. I think spending a lot of time in that area and helping them to be fully resourced is empowering for clients.
Right. You know, mm-hmm. And a lot of them, they don't even know what they like.
Yeah.
Right. They don't, because they've been so focused on the abusive person in their life.
Right.
So they don't even, you know, you ask them, what do you want to do for self-care? Like, mm-hmm. I don't know, you know, they don't even know. They've never even focused on themselves enough to know what works, how to self-soothe, what they like. So yeah, you're absolutely right. It's definitely a process of trying to kind of rediscover what helps and what makes mm-hmm. you feel better and what kind of feeds your soul and soothes your soul.
For sure. And I think for so many survivors, having a safe holding environment with a therapist that really understands narcissistic abuse or pathological relationships and is non-judgmental and provides that Rogerian positive, unconditional, positive regard means so much, because so often survivors are stigmatized and they're mislabeled. And, you know, I think part of the healing journey is truly empowerment and owning one's own power in the process of healing and recovery. And sometimes things fall apart before they're reassembled. And our job as clinical helpers is to help our clients to reassemble, and it's not an easy journey, but it's definitely very possible, if not probable, for clients that are motivated. So I think there's a lot of reason to be hopeful. It just takes some time. It's a journey and a half, isn't it?
It is. And but there's so many living examples mm-hmm. that it's possible, you know.
Wonderful. And that matters. I think when survivors hear that others have walked this path before and reached a new chapter from literally surviving to thriving, that is heartwarming for many. So I think just having that light at the end of the tunnel, that's very realistic. It's realistic for a survivor to have a better life after this experience, and that part of the silver lining in the dark cloud is more self-awareness and self-wisdom and the ability to have some fortitude and perseverance through some very challenging circumstances that now that person is equipped to totally tackle if there's a stressor that comes down the road. It's like, if they can survive this, they can survive anything, in my opinion.
Exactly. Yeah, no, I totally agree.
Yes. And so excited that you're with us today, not only to share your expertise, but June 1st is coming up around the corner, and we want to know what is happening on June 1st. What is it? tell us about what is going on that special day, if you could.
Okay. Well, what was it? Last year, I decided that I would start an awareness day.
Awesome.
I created World Narcissistic Abuse Awareness Day, and I picked June 1st for really no special reason other than it just didn't have any other conflicting things going on in that month. And mm-hmm. the first is sort of, you know, kind of a symbol of renewal and hope. And so, you know, I really just wanted to raise awareness about narcissistic abuse, and I wanted to, you know, do whatever I could, or just provide more public pathology education. You know, if down the line, maybe we could affect change in the family courts so that all our judges have to have mandatory cluster B education. Wouldn't that be great?
Oh my gosh, that would be such a wonderful thing. Yes. Oh, that was so needed. And yes. How wonderful that you have developed this World Narcissistic Abuse Awareness Day on June 1st. I think there is such a need for that. And, you know, people are just wanting to digest as much information as they possibly can. So this is a wonderful way to share a lot of information. And it is symbolic. It's sort of, it happens at the end of spring, almost the beginning of summer, new beginnings, new growth. Mm-hmm. So I think that's really cool, the timing of it. Where can listeners learn more about this? What is the website that you have about this? What can they do to learn more about this event, and how can they access the information?
Sure. So what we're doing is we're holding a telesummit to raise awareness, but also to provide healing resources to the survivor community, because there is a lack of healing resources out there.
Mm-hmm.
So we're holding a telesummit on June 1st. People can register. All they need to do to attend is have an internet connection.
Okay.
They can go to the website at www.wnaad.com,
okay.
Register, and then they'll get an email that will give them the details about how to get access to the interviews on June 1st.
Awesome.
And yeah, we're having like, I think over 18 speakers this year.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
Yeah. It's really exciting.
Mm. It's going to be chock full of information. You know, and I think it's just so much wonderful wisdom to bring awareness to narcissistic abuse and also recovery, you know, so it's really incredibly meaningful, and it's wonderful that our listeners can participate in that. And so they just register and then follow the directions at the prompt, it sounds like, to be a part of it and to hear it.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. That's all they need to do. And then they'll get emails just kind of guiding them on how to get access. And it's free. It's a free event. They're going to get over 18 hours of information and tools and insight from people, experts from around the world.
Wonderful. So helpful. And do they need to listen on June 1st, or will it be accessible past June 1st, say, for example, if they're not able to get in on that day?
Yeah, so what we're doing is it is completely free and accessible to everybody for June 1st and June 2nd.
Oh, great.
So, yeah.
Great. So. It's going to be so helpful. It's going to be just a wonderful kind of boot camp, really, of immersion into understanding how to heal and recover from narcissistic abuse. And it's a great service to the world. So thank you for doing that. And can you also tell us, our listeners, how do we find you online? Say, for example, somebody would like to have therapy with you or learn more about what you do. How do they find you online and through social media?
The best way to find me would be to go to my website.
Okay.
That's at freefromtoxic.com.
Freefromtoxic.com. Very good.
Yeah.
And it's a lovely website. I've taken a peek at it, just chock full of cool information, lots of resources. You've also written a book. Can you tell our listeners about your book a little bit?
The book is actually an anthology. So it's stories from survivors. I wrote the introduction and the rest is all stories that survivors submitted.
Okay.
And I wanted to put this book together for a couple reasons. One was that there isn't an anthology out there on the market about narcissistic abuse.
Okay.
And so to help raise awareness, to kind of bring it, you know, to raise the profile of it, but also, you know, it's true that at some point survivors need to stop reading stories about narcissistic abuse. They need to kind of get off the sites. It can keep them stuck and traumatized. But there is a period in the beginning where it is helpful. Do you know what I mean? Like getting that information is helpful. And it's what kind of gets them understanding what they've experienced. Mm-hmm. And so the book can also, by reading other people's stories, if you're having cognitive dissonance, if you're not certain if you're in an abusive relationship, after you read all these stories from different people, ages, genders, you know, all different walks of life, you will see the common threads. And I don't think anybody will not be able to know if they've been in an abusive relationship after reading this book.
Right.
You know, if there's
really, very informative. It's really helpful. And very, very empowering, I would imagine, for survivors to, you know, be able to kind of maybe pinpoint some commonalities with other people's stories and know that they're not alone. I would imagine it helps reduce isolation, too.
Absolutely. Definitely that feeling of not being alone. And then a lot of the survivors, you know, have shared how they got out of the relationships and where they are in their lives. And even in the back, a lot of the people that contributed have listed their websites or their whatever they have going on social media so that survivors can actually reach out to them.
Good. Such a wonderful service. That's great. You're doing amazing work, Bree, and just so honored to have you on the podcast today, sharing your wisdom, sharing all of the wonderful work that you're doing to help the world continue to evolve on its axis and rotate and spin in a healthy way. And you're doing incredible work with not only your writings, your blogging, your World Narcissistic Abuse Awareness Day seminars. You know, your work as a therapist and a writer, you're just doing incredible stuff. And it's just really an honor and a privilege to be able to share this time with you. So thank you again for being with us today on the Savvy Shrink. And thank you to our listeners for joining us and really appreciate your time, Bree.
Thank you, Andrea. You're very kind.
Oh, it's the honor and privilege is all mine. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you again for listening to The Savvy Shrink. For more information about this podcast, go to thesavvyshrink.com or visit my website at andreaschneiderlcsw.com. This is your host, Andrea Schneider. Until next time.